Congratulations, you. You're listening to a Radio 191 FM podcast. Yes, you are.
Program, they've recently authored a historical non-fiction novel book called Julia Eichardt, A Life of Grit and Grace, about Julia Eichardt, who is a very, very key woman in the establishment of Queenstown as a permanent town, rather than just a gold town that faded away. And she was very, very prominent in the 1800s. And so I'm very much looking forward to talking to the author, Lauren Roche, who is coming to us from Tutukaka?
Tutukaka.
Yes, yeah. Lovely. Yes. So we're going to be talking to Lauren about this new book. Good morning to you, Lauren. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well, thank you, Zach.
That's good to hear. That's very, very lovely to hear. You're currently in your writing cabin, which is a very, very vibrant area, seeing all sorts of colours.
Yeah, it's a nice creative space. It's in under a puka tree, and it's really well shaded in summer and beautiful. We get the kukupa, or do you guys call them kereru?
Oh, right.
They come and sit outside on the deck and look at me while I write.
Oh, that's so inspirational. Better.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. That's gorgeous. You mentioned before we went on air that you used to be a scarfy here in Otsipotsi. How did you find your time down here in Dunedin?
Well, it wasn't a normal studentship, really. I had a two-year-old autistic son, and I was at medical school.
Mm-hmm.
So most of my time was either med school or home. You know, yeah, there wasn't a lot of time at the cook or where everybody else went. You know, it wasn't much of a scarfy life.
No, true. Didn't go down to Castle Street.
No, I didn't go down to Castle Street.
Neither do I, to be fair. Neither do I. Now, you launched this book over at Julia Eichardt's hotel. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
That's
yeah.
Remarkable. That, it must be, what, 150 years old?
Yeah.
That's nuts.
About that, yeah. It's the most beautiful building. It's right on the shores of Lake Wakatipu, and it was one of the first hotels in Queenstown, Otahuna, and it's a legacy to the grit and determination of the people who decided that they didn't want Queenstown to be just a muddy little gold town or an abandoned town.
Mm.
They wanted it to be a place that tourists would come, and they built the hotels and the tourists came.
Mm. It's so fascinating that they clocked on to tourism being a sort of, you know, a permanent economic venture, really. How'd they cotton on to that?
I think that a lot of the early settlers came from places in Europe, and they knew Switzerland and the Alps, and they knew that Tahuna had this natural beauty like the places in Europe. And they didn't want it to just be this kind of canvas and mud town that disappeared when the gold went.
Mm.
So they started to dream that they could make a little bit of Europe down in the South Island. And they did.
Mm-hmm.
They advertised quite heavily overseas, and a very famous Victorian writer called Anthony Trollope did a tour of New Zealand that he was going to write about. He started in Invercargill and made his way north.
Mm-hmm.
Had a horrible trip because it was all muddy and he had to push his coach up the hill and do all this stuff. But Eichardt's decided to lay out the red carpet for him, and they met him at the door and they looked after him and they had his books in the library. And when his tour of New Zealand was published, they didn't even mention Eichardt's. So I imagine Julia would have been gutted, but she still used his name in advertising.
Fair enough. You got to get what you can take, right?
Yep.
Yeah, totally. Especially in those days where I was pretty dog-eat-dog world.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's nuts. You mentioned that there were a lot of gold towns that, you know, set up shop and then just completely disappeared back in the gold rush days. How many of these towns are we talking?
Oh, lots of towns.
That's nuts.
Yeah, lots and lots of them. There are still places like Macetown where you can see the remains of mining towns, places along Skippers where you can see where it was mined and then abandoned. Loads of places.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned the research for this, you know, it incorporates, you know, talking to Julia's surviving descendants, as yeah. well as poring over letters and all sorts of documents. But it also involves going to Central Otago and seeing what the vibe was like and trying to put yourself in their place and the scenery. How many visits did you make down south?
I've made two visits down south. Mm-hmm. The first was the publisher just took me around places that were really important, and the second was consolidating that knowledge. Mm-hmm. Julia actually left no diaries or letters that we have found, and she's got no direct descendants because she and her husband Albert had no children.
Oh, true.
But there are great-great-great nieces and nephews. Most of my information came from books written at the time. There's one called The Wakatipians, all about the founding of Queenstown, and also papers passed. Every little town then, because there was money from the gold, had its own newspaper, and there are really good records of who was where, when, and what was going on, what people were wearing and eating, what they were buying. Really good records in the old papers.
Mm. That's nuts that every small town had a newspaper. I mean, it's kind of true today, but I can't imagine setting up the infrastructure for back in those days to have a newspaper. That's bonkers.
It was pretty good. I mean, there's pretty good archives. Sorry, my dog's just come running in.
That's a beautiful little dog. I want to talk about more about the research and how you wrote as you researched. Did you completely compile all the research and then start writing and supplement that with additional research? Or were you doing researching and writing at the same time?
I was doing researching and writing at the same time, but I was making sure that I kept this great big Excel file of dates and places and important names and cross-referencing them with newspapers and magazines and books. I think I got up to nearly 400 entries on that. All little facts that I wanted to go in a chronological order. And then I had to write around that. There were some things, of course, that had to come from imagination.
Artistic license.
You know, because you can't write a coherent novel or narrative without using imagination.
Completely.
So I've made a book that is not a history book, but you will learn history by reading it. It is a novel. It's very readable. Got lots of great characters in it, and I hope that it gives people a feel of the times. You know, Dunedin back in those days was known as Mud Eden.
Really?
Because there were no formed streets, there was mud everywhere. There were some nice buildings, but gosh, it was hard to get from one to another.
That's miraculous, because I thought Dunedin was kind of like that was its kind of golden age back in, I mean, literally a golden age.
Yeah, it was. It was wealthy and it had some beautiful buildings, but to get anywhere, you had to traipse through an awful lot of mud.
True. Well, not much has changed since then, really. You mentioned that you spoke to the great-grandnieces and nephews of Julia. What was their image of her like compared to your discoveries about Julia? And what was their reaction when they found out a bit more about their ancestor?
Well, they're delighted to be reading the books, the ones that I've spoken to be reading the book. They had kept little things, little newspaper clippings of Julia and the Eichardt's Hotel. They were really tender about that connection with her and really interested in preserving it. So they were happy to let me become part of their ancestry tree and to go back and find the connections. And I sent things like death certificates, Julia and Albert's marriage certificate, bits and pieces that I found that I thought they might like to add into their tree, I sent through to them. Mm-hmm. So they're very happy.
That's
very,
awesome.
Very happy with the book.
That's nuts that, I know, there's still blood relatives of Julia's kicking around today. That's so awesome. Yeah. Julia was born in Tipperary in Ireland. Her parents were quite poor and they wanted to escape the very rigid English-centric class system that was in place in Ireland. So they migrated to Australia very shortly before the potato famine struck. What was life like for Julia's parents before they had her? And why didn't they migrate to America? Because as I understand, a lot of Italians, Germans and Irish went to America around that time.
They did. New Zealand looked more like Ireland to them.
Right.
I mean, even before the potato famine, there was famine in Ireland. There was an awful lot of poverty. The English ruled quite hard. And when people were unable to pay their rents, they were just evicted. It didn't matter that they had kids. It didn't matter that they were sick and starving. You know, people were kicked out. And many, many Irish were transported for having the wrong political views. And with the men transported, the women had few ways to make money. And so a lot of women were transported for theft, for thieving to feed their families, or for prostitution, because the English soldiers were coming across with tons and tons of money. And young girls and women with children did what they could to feed their families, and they were transported for it. It was a really hard time to be Irish. When the colonies opened up, the Irish were told that there was empty land that belonged to nobody, and they could go there and they could have a future in a place in the sun. Julia's dad wanted Australia because he liked the idea of the sunshine, you know?
True.
And they went, they didn't go to steal somebody else's land. They went because they were told that the land was empty and free for them. In New Zealand, unless a piece of land had a permanent Māori settlement on it, it was called wasteland.
Yeah.
And so people could get big cattle runs and stations on this wasteland that actually was really important for the Māori economy because of mahika kai, you know, the seasonal treks through the land to get food.
Yep.
That was totally disregarded. And so the settlers came to that wasteland, put their fences up, and naturally there was conflict came out of there.
Yeah. That's really, really fascinating that they wanted to go to Australia just for the sun. That's quite a simple simple desire, you know?
It is. And all the so-called empty land, that they would be able to own their own piece of dirt. They'd be able to care for their family, and they wouldn't constantly be worried about famine and poverty.
Yeah, not asking for a whole lot, really.
I've heard
some fascinating things about the sort of gender relations in settler times. How did Julia navigate those gender politics in Aotearoa when she moved here?
Yeah, when she moved here, she started working in a hotel. She knew hotels. She had lived in the Victorian goldfields, so she was used to that really unequal gender balance. You know, like there'd be 40, 50, 100 men to one woman. She was used to dealing with people and people with drink because she'd worked in her mum's hotel. She was brought up to be a very moral person. She was Catholic. She believed in her faith. And she knew how to look after herself. So when she came here, there were many, many other Irish Catholic women working in hospital. So she wasn't on her own there. But, yeah, she knew how to, she already knew how to navigate the big gender imbalances, and she knew how to look out for herself.
That's a very resilient lady.
She was.
And I want to touch on her being in a hotel because Julia's mother told her that being a hotelier is sort of a means of social mobility. You can go from being a lobby person to owning a hotel. Was that a quite well-known thing, that hotelling was a more meritocratic and socially mobile industry than most of the others back in the day?
It was well-known, and it was also particularly suited to Irish families because they had the sense of family. And if you owned a hotel, your family could work there with you and you could keep an eye on them and they would be safe. So there was the sense of family, the sense of hospitality, which the Irish were really good at. Proximity to alcohol, which wasn't always helpful.
The Irish are really good at that too.
No,
no shade to any Irish listeners. Yeah, that's quite fascinating. It's interesting how the different ethnicities of the settlers came and influenced Aotearoa, because Dunedin was founded mostly by Scottish people,
yep.
and they, you know, they didn't have it as bad as the Irish, but they did want to escape the class system, and that's yep. why they put such an emphasis of education in yep. Aotearoa, and why the university was the first ever established in the country.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And even before the university, there were lectures that hundreds of people walked to.
Mm.
Put on in Dunedin.
Mm.
Yeah, it was great place for that.
It's awesome.
And Otago was meant to be this kind of moral centre. So when the gold was first found, they really tried to hide that gold had been found.
Yeah.
They didn't want it to be public knowledge because they didn't want the lawlessness and godlessness that had been seen in California and Victoria.
Yeah. It's,
but you can't keep a secret like that for too long.
No, not really, eh? In terms of women getting an education as well, Dunedin was pretty ahead of its time.
It was indeed.
I think it had the first medical school open for ladies, as well as the first high school for women. And maybe even in the Southern Hemisphere, I think.
And Emily Sederberg, first female doctor in New Zealand.
Yes, exactly. You know? There was a very good book that came out earlier this year, all about the pioneering women graduates from the University of Otago. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but yeah, that's a really fascinating read as well.
There's a lovely book too called The Writing Desk, which is a graphic novel which touches on Emily and other settler women. It's a beautiful, beautiful book, The Writing Desk. I can't recall the author's name, but worth a look at.
For sure, I'll have to give a look at that. It's fascinating that one of the motivations for this book was, it might have been yourself or someone else, seeing that there were no women on the street names of Queenstown.
Yeah. And the house names of the local college, that's where it actually came from. The publisher's niece said, well, all the houses in our college are named after the men who founded Queenstown.
Mm.
And the publisher said to her, well, can you name some women? And she couldn't.
Yeah.
So he said, you know, we need to highlight the stories of the women who helped to make this town what it is now.
Mm-hmm. And you've done exactly that with this book. On page 60, there's a very compelling passage that goes, Julia Shanahan loves her mammy but will not live as she has done. She will not depend on a man for support. She will not be beaten down by repeated childbirth. She will not live in poverty. She will chip away at her old self and emerge as new as a dream. Did she accomplish all that?
She absolutely did accomplish all that.
Yeah, fantastic stuff. Thank you for joining me on the program, Lauren. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Zach.
Thank you so much. Oh, actually, before we do you have any final words for our listeners?
Don't be afraid to reimagine your life and go for something bigger. Have big dreams.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, they do come true.
They do indeed come true with a bit of grit and determination, as you've laid out in this book. Folks, if you want to buy this book, Julia Eichardt, A Life of Grit and Grace, you can do so on Paper Plus. Whitcalls, as well as Kite Books, you can all find them. That was Lauren Roche, the author of Julia Eichardt, A Life of Grit and Grace. We're going to be having...
Thank you for listening to a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. There's heaps more at r1.co.nz.